Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk with Gwendolyn Alfonso, who is the author of Polarized Families, Polarized Parties, Contesting Values and Economics in American Politics. The book was published by Penn Press in 2018, and I have Gwen on the phone today. Gwen, how are you doing?
Wonderful. Thank you, Heath. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, such a pleasure to have read the book. We sort of talked before about some of the things that you have to say and how it relates to some of the things that I think a lot about. Before we get to your very interesting book, maybe you can share just a little bit about yourself.
Oh, sure. So I'm Associate Professor of Politics here at Fairfield University, which is not very far from you. It's in Fairfield, Connecticut. And I have a legal background, so I was actually trained to be a lawyer. I had many levels of law degrees. So, you know, I was very much, and this is relevant actually, because I did a lot of feminist jurisprudence in another life. You know, I did a lot of family law, and I thought about family law questions because I was thinking of being a family law professor. But, you know, I had a change of heart and I decided that I really wanted to do undergraduate work, especially in political science, because the ideas of power and state were very interesting to me. So I guess I changed field and I got a PhD in political science. And I've been working on, you know, those intersections, I think, between family, law, society, and politics, and especially the state. So that's about who I am.
Yeah, no, and what you describe is so true for the book. Your book is about some big things, from the definition of the family to polarization to the role of the new right in American politics. I wonder if we could start with thinking about sort of what your book is in response to. You know, and you describe this in the book of the, so the primary thrust of scholarship on American political development of political parties is sort of a certain form. And you respond to that. I wonder if maybe you could sort of briefly describe that and what that leaves out that your book aims to address, because you're complementing a lot of great work, but you've found a hole to fill.
Mm-hmm. And you know, absolutely. I think coming into political science, and as I was, you know, becoming familiar with the literature in government and political science, I realized that there was this huge hole that, you know, the family was not really something that was discussed, particularly within, as you've mentioned, parties literature, so political parties. So while we talk a lot about, you know, polarization and polarization of political parties and their ideologies, what, you know, in commentary, that's popular commentary as well as scholarly commentary and work, you know, there is no acknowledgement of the extent to which our ideas of particularly these integral family relationships inform our worldviews in terms of how we think about state, how we think about policy, how we think about how much government should intervene in our lives. So the hole there really was that. In fact, you know, as political scientists, family was, I was dissuaded from actually looking at family because family was considered something within the domain of American studies or, you know, sociology or something like that, you know, versus I was trying to do work which is bridging some of those divides and bringing an understanding of different forms and ideas, really, of family. So family ideologies and political ideologies, right? Really try to merge those two things together, because I was convinced with all my work with law that those two things were, in fact, very deeply interdependent. So the whole really was that, is that we think we are polarized, and we think we're polarized particularly, and there's scholarly debate about whether we're polarized only about culture or we're polarized about the economy. So, you know, is it the economy stupid or is it the culture stupid, right? And I think, you know, I was trying to say that, first of all, that dichotomy is a false one, that the two things are very, very related to one another. And the way that I try to show that those economy and culture kind of come together is when we really think about, and I try to do research and demonstrate with my book, concepts of family, because concepts of family meld or marry our conceptions of the economy, our conceptions of culture, as well as therefore our conceptions of the state and government. So that kind of was the whole.
Yeah, and while much of your book focuses on the period of sort of the 1970s onward, you also make longer historical claims and have case studies from prior to that period. How far back do you go to explain the emergence of the family as an important distinction between the political parties?
Right. So it's interesting. I do go back all the way to the start of the 20th century. So I look at these three different periods. First, the Progressive Era, which is from 1900 to 1920. And then I look at post-World War II era, so the 1940s, and then leading actually 1945 to 1955. And then I look at 1970 onward to about the 2000s. So I look all the way back to the start of the 20th century. And I see, you know, I see patterns emerge right from that early period on.
Now, you offer this metaphor in the book of the hearth and the soul, as a way to understand the way that parties have looked at families differently and sort of tried to frame the importance and significance of the family. So what is the distinction between those who view the family with the hearth frame and those with the soul frame?
Mm-hmm. So the hearth frame, you know, and I try to say that both hearth and soul, and I demonstrate that they are sectional ideals. So they are actually regional ideals. They are, one is northern, more northern in its conception, and the other is more southern and rooted in very, you know, in realities of people's lives in the south versus realities of people's lives in the north. So the hearth is northern and it is more materialist, and it's really focused on the conception of the family economy and how money and materialist concerns, you know, things like how much money you have to pay rent for education, to put food on the table. So sort of these hard materialist facts, those really determine a family's success. So that's the conception of hearth. That's like the hearth ideal or approach to family and then to policy. And then there's the soul approach, which is the soul ideal as well. At the root of the soul approach is the soul family ideal. And the conception is much more morality-based. So it's not materialist. It's morality-based. It's more southern empirically in terms of how people believe families to be about. And it really, the soul ideal is upholding the fact that it doesn't matter how much money you have or how much services or programs or things you have access to, external things you have access to, the internal quality of families, its morality, its values. That's what really, really makes a difference in terms of a family's success and in terms of raising children successfully. So one is much more economics-based and the other is much more morality-based. One is much more northern and the other one is much more southern.
You demonstrate this in part of the book with bill sponsorship data from the 1900 to 2012. What do these data tell us about the ways that parties express their views on family through the legislative process?
Right. So what I do is I do bill sponsorship data, you know, in my first chapter, and, you know, it shows that family you know, is increasing in terms of its, in terms of bill sponsorship and co-sponsorship. It's increasing in its presence across the three periods. So even though in the progressive era, bills, there were much fewer bills, there still were bills that were really focused on family, but then, you know, it picks up in the post-World War II period, and then it really, really gets phenomenally, it kind of increases exponentially in the late 20th century. So it, for one, it shows that the value of family is really increasing over time as the site for partisan focus and debate, and you see that after the late 20th century, Democrats and Republicans really become very divided in terms of these heart and soul approaches. Many more Democrats, by far, a vast percentage of them, about 80-90% of them, start introducing bills that have this hearth family framework versus, you know, the same vast majority of Republicans are showing, introducing bills with the soul family framework. And I think that's a very, an interesting point, which gets missed a lot when people kind of read the book quickly, and it is a dense book, but, you know, is the fact that after the 1990s in particular, co-sponsorship especially, so co-sponsorship, you know, is when somebody introduces a bill and then looks around and asks other legislators to sign on as co-sponsors. So they don't have to do as much work, but they do want to add their bill, their names to that bill because they think that it's creditworthy in some way. So co-sponsorship, you know, also specifically shows this huge variation, this huge polarization after the 1990s. And you see that the three Congresses, especially after Contract for America, really becomes extremely polarized in terms of heart and soul, and that correlating with Republicans and Democrats co-sponsorship. So that's co-sponsorship. But you know, the main source of data that fuels, I think, the book a lot is the committee data. You know, is the data on committee hearings, and you know, I can talk more about that if you want to, but we could move on to other things as well.
Yeah, and I wanted to have plenty of time to talk about the really interesting case studies as well, and because they make up a good portion of the book. And the chapter on the New Deal period was especially interesting to me. One of the things you show in that chapter, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there are really three, not two ideas of the family. How did these three conceptions of the family map onto the party coalitions during that time period?
Right. So, I mean, it's really kind of the, and I think it's fair to say that that middle period, which was the post-World War II period, is distinctive in that way, in that there's three party coalitions on family, right? As opposed to the progressive era and as opposed to the late 20th century when there's just two, right? So you had a third faction, which was Southern Democrats, which evidenced their own ideological approach to the family, much different from non-Southern Democrats and also different from Republicans at the time as well. I guess the thing is that the Southern faction, the Southern Democrat faction, has a very strong kind of hearth approach because they are really concerned about returning, because this is actually right after World War II. So they are, you know, concerned about, for instance, returning GIs, and they are concerned about still assistance as far as housing is concerned and so on and so forth from the government for their constituents. So, you know, they're concerned about hearth issues. But at the same time, throughout the three periods, and especially at this period, they are also really concerned about morality. So what is, you know, they're concerned about the family disintegrating after returning veterans. They are concerned about the effects of war on the family and changes in the family and so on and so forth. So they are the Southern faction, Southern Democratic faction, is a mixed heart and soul faction in terms of their ideologies of family. But the Republicans still stay very strongly, soul, because they're more concerned about values, things like free market values, things like getting the government out of families. And the Democrats are still, of course, the New Deal coalition is, you know, very, very quintessentially So the Democrats, the non-Southern Democrats, are definitely all about just getting services and making sure that the materiality of the family is being assisted and supported. So that's the three factions at that time.
Yeah, the final case looks at the later time period that you've alluded to earlier, the 1970s onwards. What changes during this period to elevate the family from the kind of the margins of party politics to the center? And what are some of those issues that became so essential to understanding the party politics of that time period, especially for the new right?
Right. So, it's fascinating. I can't begin to explain how fascinated I was by seeing the extent to which now family, people start invoking the family in almost every kind of policy after, the 1970s. So I think the big changes that happen at that point, which I allude to, I think, in chapter four, is, and I think I should say this to your audience, that if people are interested only in the kind of the more contemporary period, then it's chapters four and five and not, the more historical stuff. Although I would urge folks to look at the historical stuff because the patterns are really interesting, especially with respect to the progressive era. That being said, so what's happening in the 1970s? In the 1970s, all sorts of changes are occurring. First of all, there's economic changes. So there's stagflation. There's, the OPEC oil crisis. There's also the economy is slowing down, but you also have a lot of social changes occurring. So there's all sorts of social movements, every ism that one can think of, feminism, environmentalism, gay rights, so on and so forth. There's lots of protest movements occurring that are challenging this conception of your heterosexual nuclear family. And at the same time, you see very strong demographic changes. And I think I link a lot of the policy changes to demographic changes, because the family is, as people have talked about it, being transformed, and the family gets transformed more in those, 10-20 year period than the family did in the past 5,000, as Stephanie Coutts sort of documents really well in her book. So you're talking about these cataclysmic changes happening in the family, where no longer are women choosing to just be stay-at-home moms, but women are actively entering the workforce in unprecedented numbers. These are married women in particular. There were always unmarried women in the workforce in large numbers, but married women are now entering the workforce in disproportionately large numbers. You have, all sorts of falling birth rates. You have increasing divorce rates. You have also the falling teen pregnancy, increasing teen pregnancy rates. So there's all sorts of demographic, and people's family lives are being fundamentally transformed around this time period, which opens up this whole Pandora's box in some ways of policy window too, in terms of how can members of Congress now make sense of these changes, and how can members of Congress then use the government in what sort of ways to respond to these changes.
Now, the book is... Please, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and so, Republicans and Democrats kind of fall back on their usual approaches to things. And so Republicans kind of think about it as, these transformations, and this is very, very... It's very repetitive in the data that I study. So Republicans, really say it's not about the actual changes in economics, even though, it's more difficult to have a living wage, it's more difficult to pay for children's education and so on and so forth. But they're like, that's not what is actually at the problem. The real problem is people's values have changed. The real problem is people are not as committed to one another, and people don't care about each other in the same kind of committed way as you would think of a 1950s family would do. And so they try to use government to address those changes in family values, versus the Democrats are saying it's not really about that, but it's sort of a bait and switch is what they're claiming the Republicans are doing, because they're saying it really is about making sure that families have the kind of material supports they need. So in terms of daycare, in terms of making sure that that they have a decent minimum wage and so on and so forth. So making sure that families can have enough economic wiggle room to weather these changes in some ways, and therefore just stay connected and stay married and stay stable as a family.
Now, your book isn't about our immediate time period, but it's hard not to think about our current time period and our current president in the context of these changes in the conception of the family. While you haven't written about this extensively in the book, I wonder what you think about the way in which the Trump administration and Donald Trump changes or reinforces these patterns of understanding the family. His family relationships have always been prominent in how people understand him, ranging from his relationship with his dad to his relationship with his several wives and his family as well. So how do you place Donald Trump into this development of American politics and its relationship to families?
Right. So Donald Trump is an interesting kind of Republican, right? So many would argue, and I think that I do too in somewhere else, you know, that he is very interesting in terms of, you know, he's not your average Republican, either president or, but even your average Republican partisan. So for a long time, he wasn't Republican, even in his own political affiliation. But that being said, the way I think about Donald Trump is that he is kind of more of an extreme version of the path that the Republicans set themselves down on from the 1970s on. And by that I mean is that Republicans, when they shifted in the 1970s and they shift towards these a very distinct form of family values rhetoric. So it's not just family values as in family self-sufficiency, family's ability to care for themselves, which were kind of more sort of free market kind of family values. They shift in the 1970s to embracing much more of a morality-based family value. So it's kind of religious and morality, this sort of the Rick Santorum kind of rhetoric. And when Republicans do this, when they kind of shift towards embracing more of the soul ideology in this very fervent way. And in part, I say that is because of their overtures towards the South. And that is part of the move of the Republican Party southward. So as the Republican Party moves southward, they get more religious, they get more morally fervent, and so on and so forth in their approach to family, and especially in terms of family values. So when you see Donald Trump, you see that, you know, he is still appealing, from my perspective, to that, you know, regardless of his own personal life, I guess, but he is really appealing to that same kind of base. He is still appealing to people who are morally, you know, very concerned about the state of not just the American family, but now I think broadly the American nation. So it's, you know, it's I guess I should say that they're very clear kind of lines, racial and gendered ideological lines that people have in these conceptions of family morality. So the soul family network of a framework, which is morality based, has always been about the white middle class family. And it has really always been about the white middle class nuclear family. And so that kind of, you know, racial conservatism, which it embodies, the soul family approach has embodied since the 1970s for sure. And even in the progressive era, you see that it still embodies that when we talk about intermarriage and stuff. But that racially conservative, you know, framework of thinking about families is definitely still apparent in the Trump approach and policy agenda. And this is very evident when we think about, you know, the family separation crisis, right? So with migrant families at the border, the whole crisis with migrant families and with, as they would call it, as the Trump administration calls them, illegal immigrants, is the whole idea of, you know, the fact that their families and their separation is not as important as keeping the nation together and protecting American families and their, you know, economic and social integrity, right? You know, that kind of racial conservatism really is ratcheting up, and it is ratcheting up because there's still this kind of this very fervent soul core, I think, to the Republican Party, which it set itself down upon since the 1970s.
Yeah, Gwen's book again is Polarized Families, Polarized Parties, Contesting Values and Economics in American Politics. The book is published by Penn Press in 2018 and available widely. Gwen, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome. It is an absolute pleasure. I hope I haven't gone on too much.
Not at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.